All right, what's the biggest strength of neo-Darwinism? It's genetics, by far. Francisco Ayala, he's an eminent evolutionary biologist on the West Coast. He's actually a Roman Catholic, but he's what they call a methodological naturalist. So he believes that God exists, but when he does science, he just says it's impossible for God or anyone to interfere. Okay? So he's one of the most virulent opponents of intelligent design, creation, anything like that. Ayala says molecular biology provides the most detailed and convincing evidence available for biological evolution. For example, it's often touted that humans and chimps have 99% of the same DNA. So what about that? That's a little bit of a coincidence, isn't it? That we have a nearest common ancestor, we're very close on the phylogenetic tree, we're packed in close together, and our genes just so happen to be really, really similar. Huh. And we also share similar errors in our DNA. This should get you to pause for a second. These are referred to as ancient repetitive elements. So mice, which according to the Darwinist view, these are our ancestors. We came from mice. And a mouse chromosome has certain of these elements, these repetitive elements on the chromosome in its genetics called AREs. Do you see above the human ARE and below the mouse ARE? What about up here? A truncated ARE. A truncated ARE. Here's the question. These are basically ancient repetitive elements. They're junk. They serve no purpose. And they're exactly the same in mice as they are in humans. So why would God create mice and humans separately, and yet also on their chromosomes and in their genetics, he would have the same useless junk on their DNA in these repetitive elements that don't code for anything, they're not useful for anything? Or is it more likely that these repetitive elements are basically just, you know, parts of the evolutionary process that didn't go anywhere, but they're vestiges? They were left over and passed down to us. What's the response here? The response is that what we once thought was junk, quote-unquote junk DNA, has now been reported to be exceptionally functional. The ENCODE project, the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements from 2012, found that 80% of the human genome is now found to be functional, not junk. What was interesting is, from a Darwinian perspective, they looked at this junk DNA, they're like, we can't figure out what this is for. They said, well, we believe in an unguided, you know, purposeless process, and so of course there'd be a bunch of junk crammed in there. And so they predicted it's going to be junk. Meanwhile, those who believed in design, they said, we predict that this is actually going to turn out to be functional. And sure enough, we're talking about 10 years later, it turned out they were right. Well, what's our response to the genetic similarity between species? Number one, it could be the common genes come from a common designer. Think about this. We all share the same biosphere, Earth. We all have the same food chain. How do you even have predation where animals are eating each other, or organisms are feeding off of each other, if you had radically different genetics? That seems to be impossible. So common genes could be from a common designer. Even today, we see engineers duplicating the same kind of engineering in the different things which they create. Check this out. This is from Tim Barra. He's an evolutionary biologist. This is from his book, Evolution and the Myth of Creationism. So you can tell he's going to really go after us here. He says, if you compare a 1953 and a 1954 Corvette side by side, and then you compare a 1954 and a 1955 model and so on, the descent with modification is overwhelmingly obvious. The evidence is so solid and comprehensive that it cannot be denied by reasonable people. Yeah, he's right about that. If you had a Corvette, you looked at that, okay, and then you got the next Corvette, clearly it's just a little bit different, but it's modified a little bit. And then the next Corvette, yeah, that's a little bit different than the one before. And then the 75 Corvette, the 85 Corvette, the 95 Corvette, 2005 Corvette. Okay, all the way down to the present. Yeah, I mean, I see his point that if you see all the same morphology, you know, they look the same all the way down. That shows a common descent. Anyone see a problem with that? Yeah, this is what's called Barra's blunder. He published this in a book, not realizing that the 1954 Corvette was not birthed by the 1953 Corvette, but rather it was created by engineers. And the 1955 Corvette was not birthed from the 54, it was created by engineers. And so on and so forth. This is not common descent, Tim Barra. This is common design. And so looking at these same data, you could say, well, it's common descent. You could just as easily, here's the point, you could just as easily infer common design. Because we see this all the time in a creative design. Number two, the genetic similarity between species is shared with other species. So let's think about a human. This ugly guy here. And you compare him with a chimp. So let's say he's got 99% genetic similarity. Did you know a human also has 35% genetic similarity with a daffodil? We have 80% genetic similarity with a mouse. 80%. So I don't know. Now when I look at a chimp, I see the homology. I see the morphology that we look similar. And I definitely look more similar to a chimp than I do to a daffodil. But do I look three times more similar? Am I 80% mouse? Is that what we're saying? I can't remember the data that they have on the banana. It's like we're 17% similar to a banana. So saying we're similar, I don't know what we really should take from that, after all. Number three, common defects do not prove common ancestry. You say, well, why not? Those AREs, well, it's junk DNA, which is shown to be functional. However, check this out. Humans and other primates lack the enzyme to produce vitamin C. When the explorers came across the Atlantic, they all got scurvy, right? And pirates, same thing. They got scurvy. Why? Because they didn't have any fresh fruit. All they had was salt and meat and that kind of thing. And so they got scurvy because we don't have an enzyme as Homo sapiens to produce vitamin C. So we need to eat oranges and apples and everything else to get vitamin C. Well, the same thing is true of our primate cousins, orangutans, chimps, and so forth. And so people argue that's a common defect. They lack the enzyme. We lack the enzyme. So that shows common descent. However, guinea pigs also lack this enzyme. Now, I don't know if you know the weight of what I just said there. They don't believe that guinea pigs are close to us at all on the phylogenetic tree. Many different species and orders and families and classes exist between us and guinea pigs, and yet guinea pigs don't have this enzyme just like humans. So this doesn't demonstrate common ancestry because we can look... Okay, if it does, if this is proof or evidence of common ancestry... Does this mean that when guinea pigs lack this enzyme, that's disproof or disevidence, to make up a word? Number four, recent studies have challenged the standard 99% similarity. One study done in 2003 said that we're 86% similar to chimps, not 99%. That's pretty extreme. Ann Gager, who works, she's in intelligent design, she's got degrees, you know, to boot, you can't keep up with her degrees and everything else. She puts the similarity somewhere between 90 and 95%. A lot of this is subjective, how you classify what would constitute 99% versus 86. She puts a figure at anywhere between 90 and 95. Now, what's interesting about this is, as you saw there from Francisco Ayala, he said genetics is the best evidence for Darwinism. Because here we got chimps and humans, let's say they're 90% similar. But on another part of the phylogenetic tree, way over here, we're way dissimilar. And so this would seem to confirm the theory of evolution. Because they had the tree lined up, and now we've got genetics, which is saying there's similarity on the tree just as we predicted. The problem with this is that the paleontologists, the fossil experts, who have their form of the tree, they are going to war with the molecular biologists and geneticists right now. They have what's called a consistency index. So on certain parts of the phylogenetic tree, the tree of life, on certain parts of that, they have a consistency index. So they ask the paleontologist, what do you think the tree looks like? Look at the morphology, the similarity, you give us a tree. And then they look at the geneticist and say, you give us the tree. Casey Luskin, in the book Theistic Evolution, goes through and details this. One part of the tree after another has a consistency index of 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%, or 70% consistent. You're like, what's that mean? That means in some cases, the consistency between the fossils and the genetics is only 50% true. In some cases, it's 30% true. In other cases, it's 70% true. So in other words, this whole idea that the fossils are lining up with the genetics, now in some parts of the tree it is lining up really well. In other parts, it is not lining up. So I guess I would ask again, if genetics demonstrate evidence in one part, does that mean that when genetics don't match the fossils, that serves as evidence against common descent? Let's just read here. Different proteins generate different phylogenetic trees. Yeah. The genetics and the tree of life, they're different, is what they're saying. Another team of researchers. Evolutionary trees from different genes often have conflicting branching patterns. So the fossils and the genes are not adding up together. The more we learn about genomes, the less tree-like we find their evolutionary history. That's from 2013. How about this? F. Ford Doolittle, PhD from Stanford, member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, he says molecular phylogeneticists will have failed to find the quote-unquote true tree of life, not because their methods are inadequate or because they have chosen the wrong genes, but because the history of life cannot properly be represented as a tree. This whole concept is coming into difficulty right now. Now, common descent is at the core of Darwinism. If this theory gets turned over, that will be the last thing to fall. But they're looking at this and saying, we can't line this up. Article in New Scientist, this is from 2009. This article got so much heat that Richard Dawkins said, I will never read New Scientist ever again. This author here, however, was just quoting the scientists in the field. He wasn't even coming to his own conclusions. Here's what he said. For a long time, the holy grail was to build a tree of life. Oh, I forgot to mention the cover. Darwin was wrong, cutting down the tree of life. That's the cover. For a long time, the holy grail was to build a tree of life. But today, the project lies in tatters, torn to pieces by an onslaught of negative evidence. So, what are we to conclude from all this? I've got a few thoughts to share. Number one, in my view, we shouldn't argue about this as an apologetic or an evidence for Christianity. Why not? Because there is just way, way too much interpretation involved. I remember talking to a skeptic about the origin of the universe, and he said, well, I think that the universe has always existed. And I said, well, the consensus of cosmologists today would disagree with you. He's like who? I was like, well, like John Barrow, Frank Tipler, Brian Greene, Stephen Hawking, George Ellis. I mean, I just went off the list, just listed one after another, after another, after another. And he said, well, I don't agree with that. I said, okay, so are you saying that you're disagreeing with the consensus of modern science on this subject? And he said, yes, I am. So modern science is uniform. It's clear the universe had a beginning. And I couldn't even persuade him on that point. Now, how much more difficult would it be to say, here we've got a femur, and here we've got a part of the cranium, and here we've got a couple teeth, and I'm going to argue that these are not the same species, but they're different. Or I'm going to argue humanity is different than Australopithecus. Or I'm going to argue the Cambrian explosion. See, I just don't think we should do that. There's too much interpretation of the fossils. There's too much interpretation of the genetics. And it's so interdisciplinary that you could have somebody who's an expert in one field be completely illiterate in another. And so, in my estimation, it's better to start with clear arguments. Things which are very clear, like, is there a God? Well, cosmology, physics, fine-tuning, origin of life, I think all three of those are great. The moral argument, I think, is great. Presuppositional argument, great. Prophecy, great. Evolution, I don't think is a good apologetic. I just don't. Number two, we shouldn't deny evolution. It's funny, after all this, you know, when I read evolution books, when you look at their propositions, one after another, you can say, as a Christian, I totally affirm that. Even speciation, creating a new species from another, I affirm that. What does it mean in Genesis, and they reproduced after their kinds? Family, order, phyla, species? I don't know. It just says kinds, and I don't know what that means. And so I'm fully comfortable with saying that there could be speciation, there could be microevolution. I agree with it. My point is, I just don't think it's the full explanation. Like I said at the beginning, on the one end, you've got the BioLogos or the Richard Dawkins or the Kenneth Millers out there who will say it's all evolution completely. I just don't agree with that. On the other extreme, I don't think it was completely God just creating new things out of nothing. He probably worked through a process. I don't feel comfortable planting my flag in one place or another. So we could say here that evolution is demonstrable. Insects with DDT. I mean, right on down the line, microevolution and the productive capability of Darwinism. That's true. But is it the complete answer? No, I don't believe that. And I feel very uncomfortable as a Christian putting God in shackles and saying God couldn't have intervened here. He couldn't have created miraculously here. Like the Cambrian explosion, if somebody put a gun to my head and said, do you think that God intervened there? I'd be like, probably. Yeah, it seems like it. Because if theism can offer something that naturalism can't, why not open that up as an explanatory possibility? Why are we saying, no, God doesn't intervene? So God the Father doesn't intervene, God the Father doesn't do miracles, but God the Son does. How does that make any sense? Well, we'll come back to that next week. I got a whole axe to grind on that with theistic evolution. So I haven't even gotten to the theological problems with theistic evolution, but you'll hear my rant on that next week. Number three, we need to watch for equivocating. It is good to discuss. It is good to be equipped, to be knowledgeable. I think the goal here is to be able to know a little bit about this, to be able to dialogue, and to be able to have a view which is defensible and which fits your entire worldview, that you're not just throwing out the Bible or you're throwing out science, but you're integrating these in a respectable way. That's why we got to know this. And the people that we lead to Christ, the people whom we mentor, they're going to be asking these questions, let me tell you. And you got to have good answers for them. All right, watch for equivocating. What's equivocating? Francisco Ayala says, scientists place evolution beside such established concepts as the roundness of the earth. So you're a flat earther if you deny evolution. Its rotation around the sun. You're a pre-Keplerian Copernicus geocentrist. And the molecular composition of matter. So we deny the earth is flat, we believe the earth is the center of the universe, and we don't believe in molecules. That's the level of evolution. That evolution has occurred, in other words, is a fact. He is equivocating. He is using evolution in two different ways. So when somebody says, do you believe in evolution? I say, what do you mean by evolution? Do you mean change over time? That's literally what evolution means. Changing from one thing to another. Everybody would agree with that definition of evolution. Even Ken Ham, young earth creationists, everything changes over time. Everyone believes in that. Do you believe that natural selection acting on random mutation is the mechanism for all biodiversity on planet Earth? No, I don't believe that. And many scientists are questioning that currently. That is really a crisis right now in this whole field of the neo-Darwinian synthesis. That natural selection can't be the mechanism. And I would firmly plant my flag on that because we got many scientists backing us on that who aren't into design whatsoever. Do you mean universal common ancestry? Here, we're in the minority, quite frankly. I would say 90 to 95% of scientists affirm universal common ancestry. It's only a select few. Now, we're still talking about in the thousands of scientists. And we're talking about brilliant Cambridge, Chicago-educated people who deny universal common ancestry. At the same time, could universal common ancestry be true and Christianity be true? Yeah. Because in my view, I believe that we go from, less complex things to more complex things. As long as we agree that there could be some kind of an intervention at certain points, I guess that wouldn't be universal common ancestry, but interventions where God could intervene and create things, yeah, I guess I wouldn't have a problem with that. But there's also problems with common ancestry, yeah. Or do you mean from molecules to man? See, there, I just don't agree with that. I don't believe that we went from abiotic soup to human beings that can walk and talk and create symphonies and write Hamlet and everything else. So, one thing we should also never say is evolution is just a theory. If you want to tick off a scientist, like if you really want to get him or her really upset, say evolution is just a theory. They'll say gravity's a theory. They'll say the earth being round is a theory. Everything's a theory, but it's a theory that's been demonstrated over and over. So I hope this kind of gives you some clarification on what I'm saying here. We don't want to deny it, but we're just saying we believe in an infinite personal God that works in not a closed system, but an open system. And he works in our world. And yeah, he could just let things go, and yet at the same time, I believe he's free to operate within it.